Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
capacitors. This is, I suppose, the third episode, and it's a podcast while walking, and I'm you'll hear me huffing at the start as I'm going up this big slope. Now, what I want to do in this one is really unpack what you've been taught, and more importantly, how you've been taught it, let's fight the battle of capacitors, because capacitors, more than anything else, rely on a simple explanation of being able to draw point charges on the surface. So you have two plates. On the bottom plates, typically you have little minus signs drawn as individual electrons, and you have little positive signs drawn at the top as areas of the electron of the metal denuded by individual electrons. And when you draw that, you follow a recipe, and you're able to actually draw the field lines. And I suppose I'm here to tell you that the electron as a classical point is a myth. And how could that be? Because you know it to be true. But if you really look at it, if you really take a student and you dissect how they know something to be true, what happens is that they're, a particular day in class, they're told, this is the model, and rub your hair on a balloon, and the hair will attach to a Van de Graaff generator, and they'll say, this is the model, and this is the way it is. And we say, in a Van de Graaff generator, the electrons are, individual little electrons are pulled away, and they go missing from the top, and the top of the Van de Graaff generator. So your Van de Graaff generator is one of those big metal domes with the rubber belt inside going out. And of course, the actual physics of the electroconduction process of rubber. So what actually happens is rubber becomes charged as you pull it, as it stretches. And so this stretching process means that you've got a differential charge, and it's a charge process as the rubber elongates. I think it picks up, as you elongate the rubber, it exposes the positive aspects of the molecule, and that molecule picks up an electron, and the electron gets sucked down, and you're told that those individual electrons are missing. You know, as you drain out, say if you've got a bag of ball bearings, and say it's 1,000 ball bearings, and you duck into your hand and duck in there and take 5 out, and then you have to put those ball bearings equally on a surface of paper, there'll be these gaps. And similarly, there'll be these gaps on the surface of the Van de Graaff generator where the electrons are missing. Now, I'm here to tell you that's actually not really what the case is like. Sure enough, there are those 5 electrons missing, and sure enough, the combined wave functions appear as though there is not enough charge on the surface, and the charge does appear on the surface, but there's not one little section of the metal where there's all electrons and another microscopic section which there is no metal missing. So you ask yourself, why did I believe it? How did I believe it? And how did my students believe it? And essentially, at a particular time at school, they're shown something, given an explanation, and then they're tested. Now, the testing, they say, is to check they've understood it, but basically it's conditioning, and so the students are conditioned to believe electrons are small, and say your finger is going up to the Van de Graaff generator, and you believe that individual electrons, as these microscopic particles, go to the top of your finger, and indeed your finger does have an excess of electrons, but they're not individual charges, discrete microscopic charges as drawn. I suppose the fundamental thing is that the true explanation of what's going on is what is it? It's different, and it's different largely because that's what it is, and we have a mathematical model which explains what's going on, and we arrive at the conclusion of that mathematical model without the need of years of conditioning. So this is why it takes 3 years to teach a concept of electrons, because you bring it up very, very slowly, because there's actually no rational scaffold. It's only a social scaffold, and it really is a folk belief. So those individual electrons, which are tiny, they go into orbit and go to populate many different things. So they populate the Bohr atom, and they eventually populate capacitors and stuff like that, are based on these individual sort of very tiny things. So people believe the electron is much smaller than the nucleus, but indeed it's quantum mechanics and maths tells us opposite. Now, the interesting thing is that once you've uncorked the genie of sorry for breathing so much, I wonder how this goes. Once you've uncorked the genie of using folk teaching and coercion and social structures, it's not surprising that if you actually say what it is, people will say, well, I teach by social structures, I teach by coercion, I teach by my red ink, I use the same red ink on you, and I can only understand this, or I can only misunderstand it lightly, that is, pick it up really quickly just before class, what's going on, and pick it going up. And then if I teach it year after year, I not only condition my students, but I condition myself to believe it. Now, it so happens that the point electrons moving through the wire and accumulating at the surface are a shortcut which works really well with capacitors, because the way you describe it, it looks as though the top of the capacitor has been seasoned with electrons, and the electron paint at the top has got these little blotches which are the positive things. Now, of course, microscopically the electron has to be really small, and it exists as a point, and if you were to zoom in, you don't have an area where there's the electron. You can't actually, with a microscope look at the electron moving about the place. Now this is completely palaver in terms of where there's folklore breaking. When you're believing something in folklore, it doesn't work. You sum it up, what is it? Another stronger form of folklore, which is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And indeed, of course, that doesn't really explain what's going on in a capacitor. You can take as long as you like to identify what part of metal the electron's at. I'm not asking you to do it quickly, you can do it slowly. I'm asking you to look at the position and the momentum, just the position. So it's the position here, what about another electron over there? How is the electric field uniform between them? And it's, again, you need wave mechanics to explain what's going on. or wave functions to explain what's going on, so that you can have a Fermi surface that you can construct, and the total number of electrons as you go towards the surface is insufficient. So your charge density drops as you go up there. Now, the question is, what is the value of treating electrons as electron wave functions at the surface? Well, there's several advantages. One is that it describes basically how how the surface is conductive. So conduction requires wave functions. You in fact cannot get conduction with particles. There's no reason for the electron to pull off. So if the electrons were actually a gas, the voltage of the plate would descend. So if I'm drawing current from the plate, the entire plate would draw across. Another reason that you have to look at the electron as a wave function is how they respond as a wave packet to as a wave structure, wave functions to incoming electric fields. And what they do is that they take the field, they transform, they move momentarily up energy levels. So as I have a pulse of light 1 millimeter long, so 10 centimeters long. So a pulse of light a foot long. So a pulse of light a foot long is a nanosecond. Light travels at a nanosecond. So if I have a laser pulse and that laser pulse will be a foot long. So if I could have a fast enough camera and I have it, say, going through mist, and the camera is fast enough, a nanosecond camera, I will be able to see the light travelling at nanoseconds. Now, you say, oh, this is pretty crazy stuff. How can I see light travelling at nanoseconds? Well, this is basically how 3D cameras work. They have a time resolution that a pulse goes out, and it measures the pulse coming in. It can actually photograph it. So it takes a nanosecond. You've got a light a foot long, it goes in, and what happens is it as the light goes in, it excites the wave functions. So they're not individual electrons. Individual electrons, if you've got a large pulse, would not be able to reflect the light. Energy levels and the shape of the electrons change under the influence of the light pulse, and as they relax, they emit the light pulse out as a reflection, and they in effect regenerate that light pulse coming from the shiny surface. There's a number of reasons why you want to go into physics. There's a number of reasons why you want to actually treat the vacuum between capacitors as a vacuum of space from our universe. If I had a mathematical void that is not space from our universe, so although there's nothing there, there's nothing that I can count, that gap can sustain light in between it. And so again, we're sort of moving away. So we teach the students by conditioning about the point electron, and we teach students by conditioning about a void, and we don't say the void stores energy. So just for instance, say there's a terawatt of light coming out of the sun in a second, say for instance, and now a second of light is the moon, the Earth moon distance. So the Earth moon distance out of the sun, that space is carrying a terawatt, and it moves several Earth moons, say 10 Earth moons distance out to a sphere. That sphere, that bubble of space, has a terawatt of energy in it. If I could vacuum clean up that energy into a cube and produce it, you know, produce it out, if I could vacuum it up, I could create a huge explosion. I could sort of melt the Earth, so to speak. So the space itself contains energy. If the space contains light, if the space contains electric field, there's energy in it. And the springiness of space comes into the it's called basic permittivity of space. So this is important, that this space has a springiness, contains electric field, and as you change the electric field, that creates a current, a J current, and so space actually conducts electric field, which is basically electricity. So if you can define electricity as electrons and or electric current, electric field, it goes through. And so again, as we go up, that's a point to separate coming up. So now one of the things is, I suppose, in this talk I'll try and talk about what electric field is, and you know, what fields are, and then what an electric field is, as opposed to a, I suppose a taste field might be it in a pizza, so, for instance. A pizza, that might be an example to discuss about a pizza, and then what a field line is. So let's move off. So one of the things I'm sort of signalling in this one is that what you've been taught at school is sort of like a shortcut. Like you're in a race, and the race is going the wrong direction, but you're being given a shortcut to get you to the front, but moving in the wrong direction. So you're told these little points, and it will, no doubt, it's something that you need to know to work out how to get to the first leg of the race. But there's more to the race. We're going to take off in a different direction. But if your teacher has relied purely on coercion, rewards, giving you sweets and stuff like that, you're never going to be the wiser for it. And so I hope I've at least have given you some idea about treating metals as electron wave functions and treating space as a box, a not completely empty. Space can expand, space can contain electric field energy, and magnetic field energy can contain light, or it can be the space which contains the stretchiness of it. Now, there's a similar story for gravity. So a lot of this thing is that, say, an object, a massive object, will stretch the space around it, and the stretched space is accelerating space. So a mass in that accelerating space will experience an acceleration, which we can say an unexplained acceleration, an explanation of acceleration is a force. And so we've got this entire method of coercive teaching that we say that Newton discovered gravity. It came to him like a vision from God, and that's what Newton actually did believe. He believed that by devoutly praying and contemplating, he could say that God does something, and God behaves. God uses physics to describe things, and that the sun and the earth, they just have this magic force going between them, and the teacher will draw the sun and the earth and draw the lines of force between them. Completely circular argument, and say this is the equation. Newton saw it, and at the end of it, if you peel everything up, it's God did it. God did it. And if you really peel it, go further in, there's even more theological nutcases stories behind it, and that's angelic time. That is, things can have an influence instantaneously across it. Now, that is, things, an angel can be next to you and in Rome at the same time. They can be, if you can imagine an instant of absolute time. So Newton had absolute time, and in absolute time an angel can move from here to there. And so this medieval concept got into Newton, got into everything. It's got into the school system, and we're taught of angel time. And so the thought that actually light travels at a speed through the waveguide of space, or it travels at a slower speed down the electrical waveguides. So if I control space in a way with electrical circuits, and so when I switch something, the circuit can be at different points, because inability to understand AC circuits and high speed circuits is you have to let go of angelic time, and the idea that space, that the gap between a capacitor, even if it is a void out in outer space, if I hold two plates out in space, that space will purvey electric field. Now, the electric field is not these mystical lines emanating from a source and actually attracting on the other side. And this next episode, I will. So, I don't know whether you've got too far on understanding capacitors. I suppose this one is possibly to just dislodge you in your traditional beliefs. And in my next episode, I'll go headlong into describing electric fields. You know, I'm going to have to go into electric fields. So a capacitor is a device which operates with electric fields, and you're taught to do various things. And you are conditioned to do certain things, and you are being taught that something is correct because the teacher has told you it's correct. But there's obviously a bit more history to it, so I'll try and cover that in the next episode.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.